coming up on The Green from Delaware Public Media. Governor Matt Meyer creates an Office of New Americans to help address issues facing Delaware's immigrant community.
There's going to be a lot of educating the general public about what the state can and can't do in terms of immigration policy, and then also in asking them what they would like to see.
We learn more about the new office from the man tapped to lead it, Ronnie Baltazar Lopez. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. We also delve into a recent survey of what Delawareans know about forever chemicals and the dangers they pose. Arts Playlist previews Opera Delaware's new competitive opera performance event. And Enlighten Me goes bananas with a look ahead to Banana Ball's visit to Delaware next year. It's all next on The Green, where Delawareans get tuned into a first state of mind. But first, the news from NPR. Welcome to this week's edition of The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. As of this month, Delaware has an Office of New Americans to serve and support the state's immigrant community. About 11% of Delaware residents are immigrants. That's more than 115,000 people who contribute to Delaware socially and economically, according to Office of New Americans Director Ronnie Baltazar Lopez. This week, Delaware Public Media's Abigail Lee sat down with Baltazar Lopez to talk about the office's inaugural year, which includes a listening tour with stops in all three counties.
I'm curious about Delaware's landscape overall. Can you tell me what Delaware looks like for immigrants, whether that's on an economic front, social front?
Yeah, so Delaware has a growing immigrant population. Right now, it's estimated that 1 in 9 Delawareans are immigrants, just over 11% of the state's population. And the top countries of origin for Delaware immigrants originate from Mexico, being number one, India, and then Guatemala. And these are just a kind of a glimpse of the immigration or the immigrant population in Delaware. But we know that a lot of our immigrants are also entrepreneurs or business owners. They're the backbone of our local economies as well. So about 79,000 immigrants already participate in Delaware's workforce. And of the immigrant population in Delaware, about 7,000 are entrepreneurs. So they're the ones who provide products, services, and other job opportunities for our communities. And their spending power in 2023 was about $4.2 billion. And they contribute to our economy by $1.4 billion each year. So we know that the strength of the immigrant community has in Delaware economically. So the last part was just that, we just want to find ways to integrate our Delaware immigrants into the workforce and job opportunities, because we know that Delaware is an aging state. And it's critical for immigrants to fill some of those vacancies.
This is a new office. Your first day as director was earlier this month, the 3rd of November. For those who aren't aware of this office and it being recently established, can you tell me what you're up to, what your role is, and what the office's goals are?
Yes. So the Office of New Americans is a new office established in Delaware. And it was established literally by two lines in our budget for the Department of State for fiscal year 2026, where we were required to find one full-time employee to spearhead immigration initiatives and assist immigrants in the state of Delaware in coordination with the Delaware Department of Justice's Office of Immigration Assistance. So what the governor did was launch this Office of New Americans, which had already been in the works through the legislature a couple of times, though unsuccessfully. That was spearheaded by Senator Darius Brown through different iterations of Office of New Americans bills. And so what this office would be empowered to do would be to assist immigrants very vaguely. Right now, we're trying to establish a listening tour to understand the needs and the priorities of our immigrant community first before we start detailing what the role of the office will be. But just generally speaking, based off what Office of New Americans do across the country, which right now there's about 24 states that have an office similar to this. And so what they do in other states is workforce development. They educate immigrants on the citizenship process, provide them resources to legal counsel and legal resources for them to get the legal assistance that they may need for their citizenship process, and just other things generally that help immigrants in general get assimilated into the state. And this, you know, is also entailing working with existing resources and programs that the state already offers that immigrants, regardless of their citizenship status, may qualify for.
All right, so you mentioned a listening tour. Do you know when that'll happen or any other details?
Yes, so we are trying right now to coordinate with our partner organizations across the state. We already know that some of these organizations, such as the Latin American Community Center up in Newcastle, La Esperanza down in Georgetown, and these are just to name a few, are already doing the work in the communities. So partnering with them and tapping into their existing communities, but also just generally speaking, just going across the state to different areas to understand the needs of the immigrant community. And we hope to have some type of roadmap in terms of like scheduling and dates in the new year. We know right now that with the holiday season, there's just a lot of conflicts, and we're just trying to kind of navigate this right now to maximize our resources and to maximize our outreach.
And I understand the listening tour isn't scheduled yet, but I'm sure you've considered what that might look like as you travel throughout the state. What do you anticipate you'll hear from residents and immigrants on this listening tour? Do you expect to hear any requests for specific services or resources?
I think what we'll hear, just generally speaking, from my experience in the community as a son of immigrants, being of a Latino descent, there's going to be a lot of educating the general public about what the state can and can't do in terms of immigration policy, and then also asking them for their, you know, what they would like to see. And I think we'll see a lot of individuals asking for legal support from this office, which will depend on either funding or just the existing statutes and laws that could limit us in that way. But just generally speaking, I think people are asking for help. They're asking for information about how to become citizens, residents, how to benefit from certain programs, whether it's in the utility space, whether it's healthcare, whether it's food assistance. Stuff that helps everyday Americans. I think immigrants in general are going to be, you know, curious to find out how they can access these resources, because I think a problem too is that there's a language access barrier in our communities in accessing these resources. And that's why our existing nonprofit organizations are pivotal in this work, because they do provide those services and that assistance. But we know that nonprofits are stretched thin and that their services and resources are limited as well.
I feel I would be remiss without mentioning the looming threat of ICE arrests right now in the U.S. While the state outlawed partnerships with ICE for local police departments, there's still been a documented escalated ICE presence in Delaware this year. Spotlight Delaware reports there were more criminal deportation cases in the state between January and May than in all of 2024. Can you tell me a little bit about what this office might offer in terms of support related to that threat overall?
Yeah, so you know, this office would have limited jurisdiction in terms of what the federal government is doing. But there are certain resources and tools that states and state governments can utilize to protect their immigrant community. We saw that specifically this this year, actually, with a bill, I think it was House Bill 187, that prohibited law enforcement agencies, state law enforcement agencies, from cooperating with ICE or entering into these 287G agreements. And so that was an important step for our immigrant communities, because we know that a lot of them during the first few months of the new Trump administration were scared to go to work, scared to send their kids to school, scared to, in some cases, you know, report crimes, because there was no law in the state of Delaware prohibiting law enforcement agencies from engaging with ICE. And we saw that kind of trying to appear in Camden with the Camden Police Department. So with the House Bill 187, it was an important step to ensuring that immigrants understand that they have rights too, and that they are, they should and must report crimes and not be scared of law enforcement, because the state generally speaking, is supportive of immigrants, and we want to make sure that they feel safe in our communities to send their kids to school, and to go to work. And so this office, we hope serves as a partnership to the Delaware General Assembly, to the members of the cabinet, to the governor, and to his office in terms of immigration policy, so that if there are things that the state can do and should do, that our office is being utilized for expertise, knowledge, for just resources and information about it, Delaware's immigrant population.
That about covers what I wanted to talk about with you. Thank you so much for your time. Is there anything else you'd like to talk about, the future of this department, or anything else I didn't ask that I should have?
I would just want to end with, like, I'm grateful for the opportunity. Again, Delaware is a state of neighbors. The governor has reiterated that. And so just making sure that we continue that vision for Delawareans here, but also for immigrants who have lived here, who continue to live here, and who will continue to migrate to our state. I think it's important to showcase that Delaware is a state of neighbors and that this office is a continued promise of that vision.
Thanks to Delaware Office of New Americans Director Ronnie Baltazar Lopez and our Abigail Lee for joining us on The Green this week. And The Green continues in a moment with a look at a new state survey measuring what Delawareans know about PFAS, the so-called forever chemicals, and how the state is addressing them. You're listening to The Green on Delaware Public Media. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media, and I'm Tom Byrne. There's been a fair amount of reporting about so-called forever chemicals in drinking water and the potential health impact this family of PFAS chemicals can have, including some cancers, immune system suppression, and developmental issues in children. The state of Delaware took legislative action this year to make people more aware when PFAS levels in their drinking water exceed strict health limits initially set by the EPA during the Biden administration. But how aware are people of these chemicals, the threat they pose, and what can be done to address that threat? A recent DENREC survey indicates there's still work to be done. And earlier this week, I sat down with DENREC Chief Communications Officer Nikki Lavoy and DENREC Division of Waste and Hazardous Substances Hydrologist Todd Kaiser to discuss the survey results and the state's ongoing efforts to address PFAS. Nikki, let's start with you and the survey results. Only about a third of residents, 33%, say they're confident or think they know what PFAS are. Nearly half, 45%, have never heard of PFAS. How do you characterize that? Surprising, disappointing, concerning? What does that say to you?
Yeah, so I think it probably wasn't very surprising. It probably affirmed what we already know in comparison to a national survey. Delaware survey shows a very similar never heard share, that 45%. What's good news in Delaware is we have a larger informed segment. 18% think they know, or 16% are confident, for a combined of about 33%, or one in three people in Delaware think they know what PFAS is. But yeah, it does certainly tell us that share that doesn't or isn't familiar with PFAS, it tells us that we have more work to do to help them be informed.
One bright spot is that those who are aware that these chemicals do seem to do things to kind of protect themselves. About 27% of respondents say they already use filtered or bottled water due to PFAS concerns. 26 have replaced or stopped using non-stick cookware because they use these materials. Does that give you some confidence that if you do build awareness, if you can push that 33% number up, that people will take action, do things to protect themselves?
Yeah, despite low awareness overall, a substantial number of Delawareans who do know about PFAS have started changing behavior to reduce their exposure. You cited a couple of those examples, like stopping using nonstick cookware, etc. There is a segment of the population that we surveyed who said even if they know more about it, they're not going to change their behavior. But I think the best that we can do as government and health experts is to make sure that they have information so that they can make choices that's right for them and their families.
Do you feel, Nikki, that if they maybe learned more, maybe they would change their mind about it? Maybe that they're not worried about it because they just don't know enough about it?
Yeah, I think residents have told us that if they have the information and it's accurate and it's clear, that they will make changes in their behavior. They also told us what kind of information they prefer to get. So they told us that they favor factual, easy to read materials such as newsletters and fact sheets, website articles, things that they can refer back to or that they can hold on to, as opposed to, say, community meetings, which still have value. But in terms of getting that information out, they told us how they want to receive that information.
So one thing that is happening is DENRC and DHSS are beginning a new grant program to support community outreach and awareness about PFAS using some of the Delaware PFAS settlement funds. Can you tell us a little bit more about what those grants will fund, what the goals are of that grant program?
Tom, it's a great question. We just offered through a webinar last week the initial information on what we intend to do. A lot of it kind of builds on what we learned from the survey, is that there are opportunities to teach, to share what we've been learning through time. And we recognize that so much of the PFAS topic is not something the agencies can take on alone. So we're offering this grant to locations, community groups, not-for-profits, to help build that capacity for sharing information, some of which we'll be able to provide, some of which we expect these smaller groups to be able to share in the community. The concept of being able to share complex science as a trusted advisor, as a trusted agency, we want to partner with those who are already trusted in the community, work with them, share this information, and build that resilience so people can make decisions, to Nikki's point, in their own home for themselves.
There's also legislation, SB 72, that was passed by lawmakers this year. It requires DPH, Division of Public Health, to create a website informing users of public water systems that exceed maximum contaminant limits for six kinds of PFAS. Also requires DPH to notify utilities if any chemicals are found at or above limits in public water systems. Todd, is making people aware of that tool part of the process, too, that people have that tool in their toolbox to understand, at least in terms of drinking water, what kind of PFAS risks they may face?
Well, Tom, it's part of this tool set that we do have, simply because not everyone receives their drinking water from a public water utility, from a system, from a town. Mm-hmm. A lot of us in the state rely on our own private wells, our own selves, to understand what's in our drinking water. So the SB 72 initiative is to ensure that when community systems know, when drinking water systems know, that they share that information. And again, it's that concept of individual homeowners that receive water from a drinking water system can then make decisions for themselves. Do we need to put filtration in place? Noting that SB 72 is informational and essentially voluntary at this point, the regulatory thresholds that you mentioned, the MCLs, don't come into play for compliance, i.e. the water utilities must meet, for several years. Mm-hmm. However, again, sharing of information, the things that we've learned through our survey, what we'd like to help promote through our grant, and then SB 72, we're building a knowledge base among our citizens to allow them to make good decisions for themselves or to advocate on behalf of themselves for more rapid changes and more information.
I do want to stick with the water utilities for a moment, because obviously that website's going to require sampling, testing to find out what the levels are. Can you give us kind of a sense of just where Delaware is at in terms of sampling and testing and what we do and don't know about PFAS levels currently in the state?
It's a very, very big question, not something that can be answered quite quickly. I think it's probably best to get that information from the Office of Drinking Water over in Public Health. As you may note, we did sample the aquifer or raw water in several locations in 2021 and 2022, published that and provided a bunch of statistics through that report, basically saying we're kind of in alignment nationally that there are places where there are PFAS present. Some of those locations are above what will become the regulatory thresholds in a few years. But overall, our survey did show that in places where we kind of knew already it was there, we confirmed it. Some other places, there was new information brought to light that through multiple programs offered by DENREC and the Department of Public Health, opportunities are in place now to start to mitigate those issues well before it becomes a regulatory compliance thing. Both agencies always look at this from the perspective of health and how do we start moving towards healthy communities and healthy citizens well before regulations say so.
I am curious because, I mean, we have seen some water utilities and municipalities already working on mitigation efforts on their end. And do you feel that they're on track to provide the kind of frontline mitigation that's needed going forward? Again, you said the compliance part isn't necessarily happening now. It's going to be a few years down the road. But is it a good sign that some of these utilities and municipalities are getting out ahead of it?
Absolutely, Tom. They know it's a challenge. We're there with them through the challenge. The fact that we did our sampling well before regulations were kicked into gear, gave a lot of places a knowledge base they wouldn't have had before. So again, some of these solutions here take time, and they involve some engineering, some feasibility studies, some guidance, and partnering with technical partners. So we and DHSS have been reaching out to the communities where we know we have data, shared it with them, and developed partnerships. Again, this is not going to be a challenge that we can solve in a couple of years. This will take some time, but we're started on that now. That's the best place we can be, is moving towards solutions.
You mentioned wells earlier. Should people who use wells be proactive in seeking testing and checking on what's going on in their own backyard?
Through our previous investigations, where we have detected PFAS in groundwater at either a site that's being overseen through the Hazardous Substance Cleanup Act, through our previous public water system sampling, in those areas, we've stepped out and sampled proximal private wells to see if they're also impacted. The challenge of PFAS is it does flow pretty readily through groundwater in the environment. So we have an ongoing effort to sample private wells in targeted areas of concern. As we move forward in the projects, we recognize that we don't know where all of the target areas will be. So that will be expanding in short term. We'll be offering that up more broadly in the next calendar year.
What have we learned from areas in Delaware that have seen issues with PFAS in the past? Places like Blades, around the Dover Air Force Base. Have we kind of developed some best practices to respond to issues that we do see?
Absolutely. Whenever we have a detection of concern above these low regulatory thresholds that we've developed as our action levels, our non-regulatory response levels, we'll step into a community, we'll offer public meetings, we'll inform people about PFAS, let them know why it is a concern and why we want to sample their wells through an offering. When people reach back, we can also offer short-term mitigation to those issues. Recognizing that sometimes these are isolated smaller areas and sometimes they're not. Sometimes they're broader scale topics. Within that, our best practice has been to then step into the concept of a feasibility study. What options do we have? Treatment in the home for the entire home, potential. Is it making sense to put a deeper well in or look at that option as a potential solution for that area? Interconnection to existing public water systems that then have the responsibility to make sure the water served is clean. We evaluate all of those from a logistical and cost standpoint and then make technical recommendations. So for smaller communities that are on private wells or for public systems that are looking at how to address their pending responsibility through pending regulations to treat for PFAS.
Nikki, is there a sense that you guys will go back and resurvey people? And I guess, is there goals of what you'd like to see these numbers look like when you go back out and talk to people again and see, what kind of impact these various efforts have had?
So this survey really gives us valuable insight into what Delawareans know and what they want to know about PFAS. It shows that people really care deeply about clean water and their health, but they need clear, consistent, science-based information to understand where PFAS comes from and how we're working to reduce exposure. We really do hope that this is a baseline survey to help us guide future communications and outreach about PFAS and what we should do. And, in the future, we'll be able to do it again and hopefully see some of those numbers change, particularly their awareness of what PFAS is.
Thanks to DENREC Chief Communications Officer Nikki Lavoy and DENREC Division of Waste and Hazardous Substances Hydrologist Todd Kaiser for joining us on The Green this week. Up next, Arts Playlist, where we look ahead to an Opera Delaware event that puts a competitive twist on performing opera pieces. That's next on The Green here on Delaware Public Media. Welcome back to The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. What happens when the world of opera collides with the world of boxing? We'll find out when Opera Delaware presents Opera Deathmatch next weekend at its studios in Wilmington. The show features members of the Opera Delaware company going toe-to-toe, performing some of opera's most aggressive in-your-face arias, as well as some actual glove-to-glove sparring between notable Delawareans. The event is the brainchild of Opera Delaware and First State native and former boxing champ Dave Tiberi. In this edition of Arts Playlist, Delaware Public Media's Mark Matheny sits down with Tiberi and Opera Delaware's Carrie-Anne Otagno to talk about the show and how boxing and opera are strangely similar.
This is such a unique event. So I want to start with, for the audience, an explainer of what this is and what they can expect to see and hear.
It was the brainchild of the Opera Delaware Company artists, this incredible cohort of four phenomenal professional opera singers that we have who are employed by Opera Delaware. Came up with this concept based on the fact that we have this beautiful relationship with Dave Tiberi, boxing champion and legend, and a big supporter and friend of Opera Delaware. And we came up with this idea of pairing all of opera's greatest rivalries and confrontation scenes, putting them in the boxing ring, and pairing opera and boxing and professional boxing together. So you get all the energy, the excitement, the passion of the boxing ring with the energy, excitement and passion of live singing. So this is a really exciting and innovative event, and it's coming to the Opera Delaware Studios on November 21st and 23rd for what we hope will be the first of many future collaborations with Dave Tiberi, who is such a wonderful person to get to work with.
And let me ask Dave, when you first heard this idea, what was your first reaction?
My first reaction to it was I knew that when Carrie-Anne and the team do anything at Opera Delaware, it's always first class. And so I always like to partner with organizations that really have a commitment to the community. And also, I'm pro-Delaware, being born and raised here. So when something's going on in Delaware at this magnitude, it's fun to play a part in it. And so and when we started dialoguing about it, what I thought was interesting was this would be fun. I do a boxing boot camp with some executives and all, and they just, and many of them love opera. So this was, I thought getting them involved in some capacity would be fun. And so before I got back to Carrie-Anne, I talked to them. Well, they were ecstatic about it. And as you'll hear in a little bit, when I mention some of their names, they're well-known Delawareans, but they love Gevin Back as well.
Fantastic. So what characters are squaring off in these matchups? What are some of the, I guess, what's the top of the card?
Yeah, amazing question. So we really wanted to give it that boxing feel. So we have kind of knockout rounds and an exhibition fight. So for the Opera Delaware Company artists, they are presenting some like really smackdown arias and confrontation scenes, music from Otello, from Rigoletto. You're going to have some Verdi, some Puccini, some big bombastic singing. When we get our exhibition match, we're calling it our celebrity death match. So Delaware celebrity death match. That's going to be when we get Henry Milligan in the ring against Aaron Bass on Friday night for a 60-second sparring match. And then on Sunday, Andrew Cotone, CEO of Adesis and Eternium, he will step in the ring on Sunday for the matinee performance. Those are going to be 60-second exhibition, real sparring boxing matches. So it'll contrast. We'll have our beautiful, incredible, passionate singing. Our opera singers will be stepping into the ring in robes, in boxing gloves, ready to fight. But then we'll also see some real sparring, some real fighting from these executives who are trained with Dave Tiberi.
You know, there's one thing that I love about this event is that, you know, you're obviously taking the music seriously, but you're also having a lot of fun with this event. And I wonder if you could talk a little bit about why that's such an important mindset for breaking down some of the barriers that we see a lot in classical music.
This is such a great question. There are so many barriers in classical music, and it's mostly this idea that people have in their head that they're not going to belong there, they're not going to have fun, they're not going to fit in, they're not going to know when to react or what to do. And so by combining it with something as visceral as boxing, we knew it would get the audience to really participate, and that's really what we want. So we have a bar that is sponsored generously by Dogfish Head. We have grilling before the show. We're going to have hot dogs. We got a popcorn machine. We want to create that boxing feel so that you can have all the fun that you would have in a sporting event and feel as comfortable as you would in a sporting event while experiencing this really, really high level, excellent singing and performance. So by combining those two things, we find that we're able to give people this experience that they didn't even know that they were missing.
Yeah, opera is not all tuxedos and stuffy people and uncomfortable clothes. I'm going to ask this of both of you, but I want to start with you, Dave, on this. It occurs to me that there is, as strange as it might sound, a lot of similarity between opera and sports. They're both things that nearly everybody can do, but not many people necessarily do them very well. I can throw a football, but I can't throw a football like Jalen Hurts. I can sing, but out of respect for others, I keep that to my car by myself. And I wonder if you can talk about the type of training and the behind-the-scenes work that goes into performing at an elite level.
I thought about that. I know I shared that with some of the artists last night in my own personal experience. We align so in so many areas, and I look at discipline, focus. Like last night, I didn't expect to get out of there 10 o'clock last night. That sounds like me in boxing. I would get up early in the morning. So we sacrifice a lot. There's a lot of sacrifice, a lot of commitment, and also a lot of focus, because we have to, while we're in the ring, we're trying to, just like the opera singers, you're focusing on your art, you're focusing on what you have to say and do. And boxing is what we have to do. And then in the arts with opera, you have to focus on your next lines and everything else. And so much of that takes focus and discipline. And at the same time, you want to be a crowd pleaser. And so you want to make sure the crowd is stimulated, they're excited. So all these things come together. And that's just some of many things that we talked about last night with the other artists.
I love people referring to boxing as the sweet science. Mm-hmm. And with both boxing and music, when you're on stage or on the field or in the ring, you've got to put the science and make that subconscious so you can focus on the art part of it, right?
That is such a great point. That is such a great point, because we talk about this a lot, and Dave and I have talked about this, all of the training that goes into getting preparing for boxing, preparing for a performance on stage as a singer. All of that has to go out the window so that you can be ready to improvise, so that you can be ready to literally roll with the punches, because the show must go on. You know, you have to be an entertainer. So we do years and decades of training to step into the ring for 3 minutes, or to step onto the opera stage for 3 hours and give you the best that we can give you. And that means being super present and adaptable, responding to the audience, responding to your colleagues on stage, who you're fighting with in the ring or who you're singing with, and who's sharing the space with you. So there are so many similarities between how Dave and I approach, but the main thing that I think drives both of us is just the love of the game. We love to be a part of something. We love to create something. And being around these artists and these athletes has been so inspiring.
How are the performers enjoying this? I know you said that this idea sort of started with them. How are the performers enjoying it? And how are your boxing students enjoying getting ready for this too?
Well, I'll speak to how the singers are feeling, which is ecstatic. I mean, across my time as a professional opera singer, I never got to collaborate and have this much autonomy and control over what I was programming, over how we were promoting it. I mean, the artists in this have been involved in everything from the script creation, putting together the musical programming. They're working with our technical designers on the lighting design for it and the staging. So they have such a hand in creating this and making it exactly what their vision is. And they're having such a fantastic time. The energy in the room to be able to collaborate and feel the energy from these boxers is inspiring for the singers. And I can't tell you how much fun we're having. And it's also just, it's amazing, as Dave was saying, you put all this time and effort into training to be an elite artist. And it's for moments like this. It's for moments when you get to show people and welcome people into the thing that you love so much. So for all of our singers, they're able to show people how fun and wild and silly and passionate and beautiful this art form is. And so it's really such an honor and a joy and a privilege to get to do this.
I agree wholeheartedly with Carrie Ann saying, and to put something like this together, where two of the guys that are part of this, Dr. Aaron Bass, not Aaron Bass, Dr. Aaron Bass. So he's actually overseeing a school, in Wilmington Eastside Charter. And then you have Andrew Catone, Dr. Andrew Catone, who's a scientist. But then you have Henry Milligan, a Princeton graduate, three-sport athlete at Princeton, great all-around guy. So you got three high-level people that literally are living a fun experience in their life that they would never otherwise live. And what's fun about it is the other men and women that are involved with the boxing boot camps that we have, they're excited about attending. They're going to be cheering their fighters on.
Dave, Carrie Ann, thank you so much for your time. Best of luck with Opera Deathmatch. I'm hoping I can make it up there.
Oh,
yes,
thanks,
Martin.
Thanks for your help and support.
Thanks to Opera Delaware's Vice President of Engagement, Carrie Ann Otagno, former middleweight boxing champ Dave Tiberi, and our Martin Matheny for joining us on Arts Playlist. Opera Deathmatch is November 21st and 23rd at the Opera Delaware Studios in Wilmington. More information is available at operade.org. And we wrap up The Green next with Enlighten Me, where we look ahead to Banana Ball's visit to Delaware next year. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media. Thanks for spending time with us on The Green this week. I'm Tom Byrne. Banana Ball is coming to Wilmington next summer. What is Banana Ball, you ask? Well, it's a different brand of baseball that features the fundamentals of the game combined with trick plays and unusual rules to provide entertainment for the whole family. While the Savannah Bananas are the main draw in the now 6-team league, playing in huge venues across the country, next August 13th through 15th, the Texas Tailgaters will bring the game to Wilmington's Frawley Stadium for games against the new team, the Loco Beach Coconuts. In this edition of Enlighten Me, Delaware Public Media's Joe Irizarry talks with the Texas Tailgaters' Jonathan Sunshine Looters to learn more about Banana Ball.
Banana Ball coming to Wilmington, Delaware next summer in August for 3 nights. For those who are here in Delaware who may not be familiar with Banana Ball, what is it exactly?
Yeah, it's a good question because it is so new. Banana Ball is essentially you're taking baseball and you're making it fun. You're bringing the entertainment, you're bringing the fun to baseball. It's faster. There are trick plays, so it's entertaining. And you don't even need to be a pure baseball fan to enjoy Banana Ball. You can be, but you can also come to Banana Ball for so much more. So Banana Ball, really, it's very difficult to describe without really seeing it either on TV or in person, but there is just so much that goes on in an actual Banana Ball game, and you don't even need to be watching the actual game to be entertained, which is the beauty of it. So Banana Ball, in a nutshell, it's making baseball fun, and there's tons of entertainment to go along with it.
Now, you mentioned it, there's traditional baseball. You know, you hit the ball, it's pitch, defense, or home runs, singles, doubles, all that, stolen bases, all that good stuff. But they're trick plays. What kind of trick plays will we see when we go to Frawley Stadium next August?
Man, the fans will see a combination of backflip catches. You'll see people going between the legs and around their back on ground balls. You'll see basketball style, people throwing the ball on the ground, catching it and throwing it to first base. For me personally, I played soccer in high school. I kicked the banana ball. So I'll drop the ball down, kick it back up to myself, catch it and throw it to first. So the outfielders, it's obviously a huge wow moment whenever they can do a backflip catch, because that's one of the coolest trick plays in banana ball. But there's other things that outfielders can do too. They can bat the ball up back and forth to each other. And the infielders, we can go between our legs back and forth to each other. So there is so many different trick plays and only more being created. So you might see something that you've never seen before in Delaware this upcoming August.
What position do you play?
I play the infield, primarily second base, but I can play anything in infield and also outfield as well. So second base utility, I could say.
How many trick plays have you done? I mean, you're familiar. You do trick plays also, right?
Yes.
What's your specialty?
Yes, I don't know how many trick plays I've done this season, or this past season, I should say, but my specialty is kicking the banana ball. So my one trick play that I was working on for a long time, and I was very happy when I finally did it successfully in game, was the around the world. In soccer, around the world is when you kick the ball up, you move your foot all the way around the ball, and then you kick it up again. So I was able to do that in game, which was a long time coming from so much work behind the scenes making that happen. So anything involving kicking the banana ball, that's my go-to trick plays for second base and banana ball.
And baseball fans, they're familiar with Major League Baseball, Minor League Baseball. They prepare for the season, spring training, where you do your basic baseball fundamentals. Obviously, you guys do that too. Got to get ready for the season, right? But there's also that other aspect we were just talking about with the tricks. You have to practice catching the ball behind your back and the flips and everything. What goes into that training?
Yeah, it's a good question because we do still play baseball. Like, for example, today I was still in the cage hitting and everything. But then there's also ground balls where we have to practice the fundamentals and still get good ground ball reps in. But for what the sport of banana ball is, trick plays are entertaining and we're encouraged to do them. And there will be, I think, some sort of incentive as well. In the playoffs this past year, there was an equalizer point, which I can get into in a little bit. But essentially with the equalizer point, if you're the visiting team, if you get more trick plays in the home team, you get another point in the game. So you want to be constantly practicing trick plays because you can provide value or you can provide defensive value and get offensive points, which is pretty cool. And no other sport that really happens. So it's a very unique thing in banana ball, but we're just trying to get creative as well. Just any trick plays you can do, we're building off each other. And it's a lot of fun. It's a very creative environment too.
And to also clarify, to get points in banana ball, you have to win an inning. And you win an inning, you get a point. It's not like you could score 5 runs if you're the road team, but you only get if you outscore them 5-0 or 5-1, you only get one for that inning. So there is that little strategy, that little different part of it, right?
Absolutely. It's almost like tennis. Like you have like the matches and the sets and all that. For banana ball, the beauty of that win the inning, win the point, is that there's not really blowouts. So you can go to a baseball game and it could be 10-0 in the third inning. You're like, there's no point to watch the game. But in banana ball, you could score 5 runs in the first inning, but you're only getting 1 point. So it keeps the games way more competitive until the 9th inning, where every run scores counts as a point. So you could be down 5-0 the entire game. And then in the bottom of the 9th or top of the 9th, score 6 runs, you could win the game. So there's a lot of beauty in that in banana ball, and it keeps the fans there the entire game. But the entire game is only 2 hours anyway, so it's great. It's compact. It's fast, entertaining. It's got everything right there in 2 hours.
I went to one of the games in Philadelphia this past summer, and just to see the reaction from kids and adults alike. Everybody was enthralled. I mean, obviously, there's so much. I mean, you had Joey Chestnut there with a banana dog eating contest. What is it like when you get celebrities like that or other former major leaguers to perform here? I mean, it must be amazing for you guys.
Yeah, it's pretty neat because I know when we were in Philly, we had Shane Victorino. And Shane Victorino being a Philly legend, and I'm from the Boston area, so Shane Victorino being a Boston legend as well, seeing someone in person and interacting with them and for them to speak so highly of banana ball and what we're doing, and us all seeing that individual, Shane Victorino in this case, on TV, it's pretty special. And a lot of us always dreamed of playing these major league stadiums. So to interact with these players who got to do that is really neat. And then for Joey Chestnut, for example, like that's just crazy. He's a global, at least national icon. And to have him eating hot dogs in right field during the game was awesome. We're just such a banana ball moment right there. Like anything can happen in banana ball. And that's a perfect example of that.
That's right. To clarify, Joey Chestnut was having that contest while a game was still going on. So that was a classic moment there for the people in Philadelphia. And speaking, you were at Citizens Bank Park, Yankee Stadium, Coors Field in Denver, Bank of America Field in Charlotte, the football stadium, sell out football stadiums with banana ball. And then also Yankee Stadium, Citizens Bank Park, which always sell out, but Coors Field, which usually doesn't sell out for the Rockies, but they sold out for banana ball. That must be amazing for all the players that, look, we're big time. Yeah, I mean, the people love it. How does that feel for you guys?
It's pretty humbling because we're doing this thing where we're traveling around the country and we're selling out stadiums. And I know in particular, the Bananas and the Firefighters played in that series. The Tailgaters did not. That was a team I was on last year. But what I do know is that Jesse, and I give a lot of credit to Jesse, we usually do a fans first, or I'm sorry, we do it's a staff chat right before the game of the first game of the series, just for everyone, all staff, players, coaches, all that, just to kind of get on the same page before the series and set the tone. And usually it's behind home plate. But for this meeting, they went all the way up to the top of the stadium. And Jesse wanted to do that to build perspective. Like, we don't want to lose sight of the fans that are up here in the nosebleeds, in the third deck, of Coors Field just because we're getting so big and playing in front of 50,000 people. It's like these fans up here are still important, or still the most important fans as the ones that are on field level. And no matter how big Banana Ball gets, whether it's 50,000 fans in Coors Field or 80,000 in a football stadium, all the fans are really valued because without the fans, we don't get to do what we do.
And to clarify, your squad and the other teams are not the Washington Generals or the Harlem Globetrotters when it comes to the Bananas, right? You win some games, you'll beat the Bananas, and that makes it a special night. You don't know who's going to win, right?
Absolutely. The baseball portion of Banana Ball is not scripted whatsoever. The entertainment stuff, which we rehearse and practice, that is scripted in terms of, okay, we know this at-bat, second at-bat, so-and-so is going to have a walk-up and do this dance. We know that. But the actual baseball of Banana Ball is not scripted whatsoever. You can't script a baseball game. You can't tell someone, hey, home run on this pitch right here. Let's go do that. Or, hey, strike this guy out. And that makes a lot of beauty to it because every game is so different. You can go to the Harlem Globetrotters and the show is pretty similar, but in Banana Ball, the show is different every single game. From whether it's the Saturday game or the Sunday game, the Friday game or Saturday game, it doesn't matter. Every game is completely different, which makes it really, really neat.
Expanding this year, the Loco Beach Coconuts, their primetime coach, the aforementioned Shane Victorino, and the Indianapolis Clowns, their primetime coach, another former Phillies player, Ryan Howard. What does this mean to add more teams, bring former major leaguers like this on board for the new league?
It means a lot because to have not only two major league baseball players, but I'm pretty sure two all-stars and one of them an MVP and both of them World Series champions, I'm pretty sure, to have caliber of MLB players pretty much endorsing Banana Ball and being involved in it shows where Banana Ball was to where it is now, and that it's almost legitimizing, not that Banana Ball wasn't legit before, but showing like, hey, this is Banana Ball, this is real, this is legit, like this is real competitive ball, but with all the entertainment pieces together. And the fact that they embrace it so much, we were able to talk to Shane Victorino when we were in Philly, and he's like, man, this is awesome. You get to do this, you're getting paid to play the sport that you love, and you're having fun while you're doing it. And Ryan Howard agreed, like when he was at the city selection show. And it's really special because, again, like we see these guys on TV and now they're endorsing the sport that we play. It's pretty cool. And they're really embracing it and loving it and being primetime coaches. Like, what a cool concept. So we're excited to have them this year and get to interact with them.
And in the end, there will be a playoff. There's a championship. There's going to be a winner out of all of this, right?
Absolutely. Yes. Yeah. So now all 16 are starting right at the same time, which is really cool to have a full season of Banana Ball together. We can see the rankings. We'll see where teams are at and all that in the standings. So it'll be really neat. I think we're all very excited for that. Yeah, we're excited for the competition to continue to increase as the years go on.
Thanks to Texas Tailgaters Banana Ball player Jonathan Sunshine Luders and our Joey Irizarry for enlightening us this week. Again, Luder and the Texas Tailgaters will bring Banana Ball to Frawley Stadium in Wilmington next year, playing games against the Loco Beach Coconuts August 13th through 15th. And that's a wrap on this edition of The Green. The stories and interviews you've heard are online right now at DelawarePublic.org. Just head to The Green's page on our website. You can also sign up for our weekly newsletter there by clicking Newsletters at the top of the page. And remember, The Green is also available via podcast at our website, as well as Apple Podcasts, YouTube, and the NPR and Delaware Public Media apps. We'd also like to hear from you. Give us your feedback and story ideas on our Facebook page or by emailing us at thegreen@delawarepublic.org. Thanks to all those who helped make this week's show possible, Delaware Public Media's Joey Irizarry, Abigail Lee, and Martin Matheny. For all of them and the rest of the staff here at Delaware Public Media, I'm Tom Byrne saying thanks for joining us this week. And we'll see you again next week on The Green, where Delawareans get tuned into a first state of mind.